the subject that we've been studying,
which is the historical sociology of fish, in particular two special fish. For the last couple of weeks, we've been studying the sturgeon, and both the sturgeon and the swordfish have evolved, in my lifetime at least, from being kosher fish to being non-kosher fish. But beyond that, the similarities disappear. And what we found in our first cure, first of all, the sturgeon is rather peculiar in the sense that it's an ancient fish. It doesn't have a backbone. It has, like the sharks, it has cartilage instead of bone. It doesn't have what we would call a regular mouth with teeth. What it has is a hole on the bottom from which a sort of suction tube emerges, which it uses to suck up mollusks and other invertebrates on the bottom. That's how it feeds, vacuum cleaner style. You have a picture of it right in front of you. And the nature of its scales is a bit different from the scales of most fish that we're used to. That on that other thing, you can see a list of four different types of scales that fish have. And the sturgeon has a type of scale which is sort of halfway in between the scales of the shark and the scales of most bony fish. And the issue is whether the sturgeon counts as a kosher fish or not. Basically, the question is, do its scales count as scales to qualify the Tarasas Napir Vekaskeset, and do the scales of the sturgeon qualify as Kaskeset? The Ramban, in his Perush to the Torah, defines Kaskeset. He says that even though Rashi says that Snapir means... Okay, so pull it all the way to the back.
You have room in the back, you can barely turn around.
Ah, good, so our Hungarian friends are here. No, it comes out, right. No, it has these little barbells at the bottom which allows it to feel whether there's something edible along the bottom, and then when there's something there, protrudes its tube and sucks it up. The Ramban in his Perush to the Torah said that we have to that even though Rashi says that the distinction between a snapir, which is something that moves, the fin, something which the fish moves with, and therefore it's a movable organ, and the kaskeset is not movable, nevertheless, it does not mean that the kaskeset is a permanent part of the fish's structure, because the definition of kaskeset means that it can be removed, either with by hand or with a utensil. So, although this was not found anywhere in the Talmud, the Ramban added as a requirement for the definition of kaskeset that it be removable. And the problem with the scales of the sturgeon is that they're not easily removable in the same way that if you just take an ordinary scraper, or most fish that we're accustomed to, you simply scrape them and the scales come off. So that was the situation with the Ramban. Now, the Ohel Moed, who also came from Girona, which is a very small town as far as the Jewish population is concerned, maybe 300 people, and who overlapped either with the Ramban or immediately after, my impression is that he probably was alive at the time of the Ramban, says explicitly that the sturgeon is a permissible fish, although some people don't allow it, and the Ramban allowed the sturgeon, permitted the sturgeon, because he put the fish in boiling water, in which case the scales came off. So that was the situation in the 13th century. And I haven't...
Chicken, for instance, mm-hmm. is not allowed in boiling water to take the
feathers off. Yeah, but that's for a different reason. Yeah. Now, that was the situation until the time that we're dealing with, which is at the very end of the 18th century. Last week, we read a tshuva of the Noda Yehuda, who was the leading rabbi in Prague from around 1755 until his death, around 1790, I don't remember the exact date. And someone asked him whether you're allowed to eat asparagine or not. Previously, he had written a tshuva, which is important for us, in which he indicated that you're allowed to drink beer even though it's made with the swim bladder of sturgeons to this very day. That's how beers are cleared, and that's why vegans, for example, are very fussy about what kind of a beer they'll drink or not drink, because their rules are more strict than ours. So at that earlier tshuva, the Mada Yehuda had assumed, probably had never seen this fish, someone simply posed the abstract problem to him. The processing of certain types of wine and beers and meat were made by clearing the material using up the isinglass, which is manufactured from the swim bladders of sturgeon. Does this render the beer prohibited or not? Unfortunately for us, even though sturgeons are now a non-kosher fish, according to the OU, it doesn't impair the drinkability of beer because we can rely on this other tshuva of another beer.
Why would a filter render it kosher? It's not part of it.
No, they ground this stuff up and they put it in and then it sinks to the bottom. That's how it works. It's a form, something like a gelatin, which attracts all of the
dust. Not catalyst, though.
No. It's not a straight filter. It's a material that's added to the beer. Okay. So let me quickly reread to you the tshuva of the Noda of Yehuda. I don't have a date for this exactly, but it's presumably in the early 1780s. Mikhtavo higiani macharat yom ha-kippurim im hadag. Your letter came to my house after the day after Yom Kippur, along with the specimen of the fish. Vehine, asher sha'al im lesmoch al ha'idut ha-me'idim ha'ochlim oto b'mkoman. Are you allowed to rely on the testimony of those who claim that they have been eating this fish in their homes, if that is in their place of origin? Hine l'inyan ne'emanut ha'ed, ha'vadai de'ed achad ne'eman b'isurim. Did you get the information from me?
I tried to ask my detective to email.
Right.
He was looking for it.
Okay. All right. As far as is concerned, you can rely on this. And then he goes on to say that there might be...
Which one?
Just Hafchet. We read this last week.
I know, but I haven't. Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. I'm going to just read quickly because I want to get on to the new material. Va'amnam... Ani nisiti dagze. I have examined this fish. V'yeshlo shtei shurot kaskasim, shura achat b'tzad yamin v'shura achat b'tzad smol. It has two lines of scales on each side. Uma b'kach she'enam niklafim b'yad. Why should it matter that we cannot remove these scales by hand? V'halo niklafim b'kli. They can be removed with a utensil. V'gam nisiti la'achar she'shara b'kli she'ni b'mayim min ha'efer she'karim loig k'mo shalosh shalot. I let this specimen soak in warm water with lye for about 3 hours. V'niklafu b'yad. And then I was able to remove them by hand. And according to my opinion, even if they would not be removable before soaking in the slide at all, in other words, he decides very explicitly that the sterlet, as we will see, that was sort of a kind of sturgeon, the sterlet, a subspecies in the same family as the sturgeon, was permissible. And this was the decision of the leading rabbinical authority and the rabbi of the largest Jewish community probably in the world at that time, the chief rabbi of Prague in the early 1780s. Question?
So something like 3 hours of lots of things.
Well, he said he could remove it with his hand without necessarily... Remember, according to him, this whole notion of the Ramban requiring it be removable was questionable. And remember also that the Ramban, according to the testimony of the Ohel Moed, allowed this a similar fish, the sturgeon instead of the sterlet, by boiling it for a while, and also things will come off if you boil them for a while. Okay. That's more or less where we got to last time, because we spent a good bit of time discussing the history of the situation, because soon after the Rabbi Yehuda's death, this became a subject of violent controversy. And the reason that it became a subject of violent controversy, well, we can understand that there was some controversy because, as Mr. Weinstein says, the fish looks a little ugly, not like other fish, and there were various communities which did not eat this fish. But remember, there are mixtures of communities who did one thing or another. There are many things that the Sephardim eat that the Ashkenazim do not eat, and vice versa, and those did not become a subject of violent controversy. So we will now trace that this did become an issue of violent controversy about 10 years or so after the death of the Nodiv Yehuda. And the reason for this is complicated, and also I don't know which is cause and which is effect here. That is, certainly the rumblings of reform had reached Prague from Berlin even during the time of the lifetime of the Nodiv Yehuda, and we will see that the Nodiv Yehuda was such a great man and such a terrific leader that the influence, at least in his lifetime and maybe for one generation after his lifetime, of the reform from Berlin were relatively moderate compared to what was happening elsewhere. But the important thing to remember was the difference in the structure of Jewish communal life in the three places that play a key role here. One is the structure of Jewish life in Bohemia in the 18th century, the structure of Jewish life in Moravia in the 18th century, and the structure of Jewish life in Hungary, where the violent controversy really broke out. So let me remind you of some facts. First of all, let me read from McCagg's book a little bit. When the Habsburg Empire came to its end in the early 20th century, that is at the end of World War I, there were Jews resident in every part of it. This had not always been so, however, and in the century after Leopold I's expulsion of the Jews from his capital, Habsburg Jewry was effectively constricted to the three lands of the Bohemian crown: Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia. In the Alpine provinces, modern-day Austria, Jews were then allowed only in the tiny Vorarlberg town of Hartheims. In Trieste and nearby Gorizia and Grado, there were tiny Ashkenazi Jewish communities. The Habsburgs had not yet acquired Venice, Dalmatia, and Bosnia, where there were small Sephardic communities, which at a later date constituted a Habsburg Jewry of the South. And in vast Hungary, which in the 18th century became the Habsburg territorial anchor on the Danube, such Jews as remained after the late medieval expulsions had been victims of 150 years of Turkish wars. Substantial numbers of Sephardim had come into the Hungarian towns in the late 16th century under Turkish rule, but these seem on the whole to have retreated after 1688 with the Sultan's army. By 1700, only a few ancient communities survived along the Moravian frontier, in today's Burgenland. After the Habsburg reconquest, because of the general depopulation, the royal authorities allowed Jewish immigration. Some of the refugees from Vienna thereupon ended up in Bratislava, contributing to a new community there. During the 18th century, many more Jews immigrated to Hungary from Bohemia and Moravia, but until late in the century, these could still be considered as having one foot at home. So the first thing to remember is that Jewish Hungary, except for the small Sephardic Jewish communities who remained after the Turkish rule, was essentially a country of immigrants. Immigrants in the first two-thirds of the 18th century from Bohemia and
Moravia. After that, they went to Galicia, also to Hungary.
Yes. Once there was the partition of Poland and Galicia came under Habsburg rule, that is in the last third of the 18th century, there was a vast immigration from Galicia. So you're quite right. There were three sources of immigration: Bohemia and Moravia in the first two-thirds of the 18th century, and Galicia in the last third of the 18th century. And there's a difference in quality or in mindset between the Moravian Jews, the Bohemian Jews, and the Galician Jews, especially as regards openness to what was happening in Western Europe. I mean, in Galicia, yes. Right. So they were moving from, but so they were either living in Russian, that was after the partition of Poland, in which, in Lemberg. But Lemberg, of course, was under Austrian control, But the Galician Jews were completely opposed to any form of Western knowledge. We'll see that the Note of Yehuda was somewhat open to the sciences and to language and something like that, and the Moravian Jews were sort of in between. So even though, as we were one of the key players in tonight's shiur, it was the chief rabbi of Moravia at the time, Rabbi Mordechai Bonnet, and he was probably shocked by what was happening in Prague. If you compare him to, say, Rabbi Ornstein, who was the chief rabbi of Lemberg at the time, he must have felt a bit left-wing radical. So we had three different groups of this was before the invention of orthodoxy, which came, say, in the 1830s or 40s. It is difficult to estimate how large Habsburg Jewry, in other words, Jewry under the Bohemian crown, was in that century. Modern censuses were not taken, and even if they had been, the Jews would surely have avoided being counted out of fear of the tax collector. But we do have some rough figures. About 1635, it was estimated there were some 14,000 Jewish taxpayers in Bohemia outside of Prague, and some 7,800 in that city itself. By 1700, the Jewish population of the capital had mushroomed to over 11,000, comprising perhaps a fourth of the civic population, and making Prague the largest urban Ashkenazi Jewish community in Europe. Just after 1700, fire and plague set back the Prague community severely. All told, Habsburg Jewry may have comprised 150,000 souls by the third quarter of the 18th century. At that time, this was a very substantial population. In all France, there were not 40,000 Jews at the time of the Revolution. In England and Holland, far fewer. There had been no Jews in Prussia in the 17th century due to expulsions, and in the 18th, apart from some thousands in formerly Austria Silesia, there was only a privileged community of 2,000 to 3,000 in Berlin. So Prague was the New York City of all of Jewry at that time. Let me also read from Professor Keevil's book. These are two excellent books. This is by McCagg, History of the Habsburg Jews, and this is by Keevil, Languages of Community, the Jewish Experience in the Czech Lands.
Where were the biggest
Jews? There was a huge Jewish population explosion in the 19th century. I would guess that at the beginning of the 19th century, there may have been 2 million Jews worldwide, which grew to about 10 million by the end of the 19th century. So one of the facts of the 19th century was a huge increase in Jewish population. Okay. Consequently, from the middle of the 15th century until the middle of the 19th century, the cities of Moravia were closed to Jewish settlement. During this time, the Jewish population in Moravia acquired a pattern that was quite distinct from that of neighboring Bohemia, much closer, in fact, to that which could be found in central and eastern Poland in the 17th and 19th century. Moravian Jews lived, by and large, in small to medium-sized towns under the patronage of the nobility. They were able to observe many of the features of urban culture and occupational life, but fell outside the purview of burgher control and competition, as the towns that they now inhabited were the private domain of magnate families. Mikulov, that is Nikolsburg, which was to become the seat of organized Jewish community in Moravia, provides a case in point. The magnate owners of the town, the Dietrichsiens, received Jewish refugees from Vienna in 1421 and from the Moravian cities of Brno and Znomno in 1454. Mikulov was a fairly large market town which provided Jews with economic opportunities tied to agricultural production, trade, and commerce. The Dietrichsiens placed few restrictions on the Jewish population, and the community, nestled behind beneath a castle on a street named appropriately Zaharadim, grew steadily throughout the early modern period. So the difference, I don't want to spend too much time on all of this history, the difference between the Bohemian Jewry and the Moravian Jewry was that on the one hand, there was in Bohemia a large urban center, Prague, and no Jews living in any of the other cities or even medium-sized towns, but scattered throughout the countryside. And there was a bit of tension, perhaps, between the chief rabbi of Prague and the Landesrabbiner of the rest of the country, even though the Habsburg Empire and eventually the community as a whole recognized the chief rabbi of Prague as the rabbi of the whole country. In Moravia, lived in very small to medium-sized towns, but the entire country was well organized, primarily thanks to the work of Menachem Mendel Krachmal, who was the chief rabbi of Moravia in the 17th century, and that he established enough of a constitution, enough bylaws for governing the entire country, which persisted through the end of the 18th century. So now perhaps let me read a little bit about Prague and especially about the Mode of Yehuda. Again, I will read from two sources, from Macag. We read a bit of this last time. Nevertheless, there was a Prague Jewish Enlightenment, and it flourished because of a peculiar circumstance within the autonomous framework of Prague Jewry. In Maria Theresa's day, the chief rabbi of the Prague community was Ezekiel Landau. That's the author of the Note of Yehuda, a renowned Talmudist, a relentless warrior against Sabbatinism, and he initially assumed an open stance on matters of Jewish enlightenment. It was in the absence of his disapproval that Mendelssohn's early, pre-1783 work, at least, gained a wide reading by students from all over Central and Eastern Europe who came to study in Prague. How could this be? How could a distinguished Orthodox rabbi act somehow as a transmitter of enlightened ideas? The answer is surely in the part that Jewish tradition was then not yet what it had become in the 19th century. In other words, Orthodoxy had not yet been invented. Perhaps one may say that in Landau's day it bound personal piety, avid adherence to devotional law, and respect for Jewish learning to a philosophical flexibility recalling the naive ecumenism of pre-Reformation Roman Christianity. It was no doubt extremely dogmatic, close to outside ideas, but was also extremely diverse and contentious, and not insensitive to new scientific uses of the mind. Remember that in the golden age of Prague Jewry, which occurred in the 16th century, the Maharal de Prague, and certainly David Ganz, had connections with Kepler and with Tycho Brahe. Okay. Further, the Orthodox then recognized a major foe within Judaism, which was not Haskalah, the Enlightenment. This was heresy for which, in the most part, meant Sabbatinism, false messianism. Even the Mitnagdim, the self-styled opponents who assumed the lead in Polish-Lithuanian Jewry in the late 18th century, were not initially opposed to Haskalah. They opposed Hasidism and its pietist emphasis. Only later did they come to distrust the reformers from the West. Landau's priorities were similar. And let me also cut some of this historical stuff short. Let me also read from Kiebel about the same subject. The tone of moderation and traditionalism, so characteristic of the Prague Haskalah, was not necessarily unique to the city. Yet the notion of a conservative enlightenment with quasi-national overtones may indeed have comprised the essence of Prague's contribution to the Jewish Enlightenment. The sources of this conservatism lay in the areas of institutional leadership and what may be called cultural geography. Prague's rabbinate, under the direction of Ezekiel Landau, and then afterwards Eliezer Fleckless, enjoyed tremendous prestige both at home and abroad. It is safe to assume that these men possessed a greater ability than their contemporaries in Western Europe to either thwart or approve measures that could affect the nature of Jewish life in their community. Hence, the attitude of such personalities towards the spread of Haskalah, as well towards the growing interest of the central government in Jewish affairs, may have been crucial to the formation of changes in Prague. The strong position taken by the conservatives such as Landau may have engendered tension between the leadership of the Prague community and the early Maskilim. Evidence of mild generational conflict, for example, does exist. The remarkable thing about Prague, however, is that the fathers and sons, on the whole, did not divide. In fact, from 1790 to 1810, the Prague Maskilim stood out as staunch defenders of the rabbinic leadership. The Maskil Baruch Yaitelis, 1762 to 1813, submitted a eulogy for Landau to Hamaasef following Landau's death in 1793. He then reacted with a bitter attack on the periodical when it ridiculed the eulogy and its object of praise. Later, Yaitlis joined forces with Rabbi Eliezer Fleichlis in denouncing the influence of the Frankists within the Flag Jewish community. Israel Landau, the late Shift Rabbi's youngest son, dominated Haskalah publishing in Prague during the last decade of the century with works not only in philology and geography, but also in popular halachic education. Bohemia's proximity to the traditional societies of Poland, Hungary, and Adin Moravia also contributed to its traditional complexion. And the effects of the Familiantengesetze, remember that Maria Theresa instituted a law saying that only one son in any family could marry. So therefore, children either have to marry secretly and live out in the small towns or leave the country altogether. Okay. Which forced younger sons to emigrate in order to marry and establish households, intensified whatever ties geography alone may have produced. A network of intimate family connections extended from Bohemia to the east and north, wherever younger family branches were able to establish themselves. Ezekiel Landau's immediate family provides interesting examples of such cross-communal ties. His eldest son, Jacob, a rabbi in his own right who made his living as a merchant, settled in Brody, remember that's in Galicia, where his father had once served as dayan. There he apparently maintained cordial relations with representatives of Galician Haskalah. Israel Landau, that's the youngest son, though born and raised in Prague, married a Polish Jew with whom he had two sons. She, apparently alarmed at the, quote, liberal spirit of Jewish life in the city, and pleaded with her husband to leave Prague and return with her and her children to Poland. Landau demurred. His wife demanded and received a bill of divorce. She then settled with her two boys in Poland, and her husband set out to find a new wife. This time he chose someone from a progressive Dutch Jewish family. One of the sons from the first marriage became a rabbi in Brody. A son from the second marriage, Moses Landau, established himself as printer and publisher in Prague, producing works in Hebrew and German, including several volumes of the periodical Cheren Chet. So you can see that a Polish Jew married to even the son of the chief rabbi in Prague couldn't tolerate the, quote, liberal atmosphere in Prague, and demanded that the husband return to New York, and when he refused, she insisted on getting a get. So that shows you that there were all of these various different types of tensions, but in Hungary, where you had three different immigrant Jewish communities, it's clear that it was just rife for some kind of tension, just the same as the effect that the immigration of the Hungarian Jews to this country after World War II changed the complexion of what is called Orthodox Jewry in this country immensely in the last 50 years. Now, last time I told you that the object of our discussion is the war between Aaron Chorin, or Aaron Choriner, who was a student of Rabbi Landau in Landau's yeshiva, as was Mordechai Banet, the chief rabbi of Nikolsburg, that is the chief rabbi of Moravia. And Chorin eventually turned into a leader of the reform movement in Hungary. But at the time we're discussing it, as far as one can tell, he was just simply another rabbi, graduate of the Prague yeshiva, which was the largest yeshiva in Europe at the time. And I mentioned to you that I couldn't find this particular pamphlet that he had written on the issue of the Sturgeon, but in the past week I was able to find it. So here is, I will pass this out, this is the pamphlet. It's Imre Yosher from 1798, Harvard Library. These small pamphlets like this tend to get lost. So you can have the original. I don't plan to read all of it today, but I will read, and I Xerox separately, a separate section. Okay. So I think we will have this.
Probably haven't ever had this many copies made into this.
Okay. So this is Chorin's response to an attack on him by Griesaber, who
protested the fact that Aaron Chorin had followed what his teacher had said and declared the sterlet to be a kosher fish. And this caused an enormous battle. And rather than reading all of the letters, I will first read...
Where was
Chorin the rabbi?
Where was he at the time when he made the declaration that
he was the rabbi in Arad. Arad is a town which is currently within in Romania, close to the Hungarian border, two provinces down in Romania from the province of Satu Mare, that is St. Mary, that is Satma. it's a world of difference. Yes. Right. Yes, and two stations down, I would imagine, is Arad.
Okay.
Yes, along the border. So
and the person who attacked him was where?
He was in another town in Pax.
Pax.
That's in Hungary.
Mamala. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I Xerox, especially the one thing that I do want to read in this home pamphlet, which is a letter from Rabbi Bonnet, who was at the time the chief rabbi of Moravia, to Aaron Chorin. So we can pass this down and let's read it. Okay? So this is Simon Zion in the handout that I gave, but rather than have you search for it, it was easier to just Xerox this one page separately and read it. Simon Zion. Remember, this is from Corin's pamphlet. Elohim Divrei HaGaon Rabbi. Do you have it? Elohim Divrei HaGaon Rabbi Mordechai Bonnet. Av Besdin Rosh Metifta Tachila Kadisha Nicholsburg. So he was the chief rabbi of Moravia at the time. Baruch Hashem, Yom Aleph, Chof Yed Shvat, Tov Kuf Nun Chet. So we're dealing with 1798. Okay? Hodchim B'Shalom Rav, we open with Elav Yikarev Yarev, Ho Arav HaMuflok, Bo Noena, Rav Aran, Ru Av Besdin, Kekod Tisha Arad. Okay. So this is sort of like Dear Sir. Understand that all these honorifics are dear sir. Le kol korei achol korei ba'aznai, hear all the repeated complaints in my ears. Kol anot anishamea, I hear the. Remember, this is from Moshe Rabbeinu being told that the Jews have sinned at the Egel. Am Hashem avirin alav, that the Jews are complaining you, ki paro aharon l'shem tza, because Aharon, that is, his name remember was Aaron Harina, has become a hem. Ba'amor lahem al hadag ha-nikra shtarlach, ba'hadag ha-nikra tik, ki hem tahorim. And I don't know what the tik is exactly, but it's your job to find out. Okay.
I have one soaking in lies.
Right. Al-Kain, Yochlu of Nei Yisrael. And therefore, because you, like the chet of Aaron HaKohen, you also have caused the Jews to sin, and they're eating this fish. Uva Mechilat Kvodo, with all due respect, Hitir V'Teheret HaSheretz MeHaTorah. You have permitted something which is a sheretz. You had no reasons whatsoever to permit this fish. You just paid attention to some nonsense that passes by reported that people used to eat this fish in Turkey. Without even writing to the rabbis in Turkey whether these people are telling the truth about eating this fish. Remember, the note of Yehuda had said explicitly that if people report that they have been eating the fish, that's perfectly valid testimony. You don't have to get a letter of certification from any rabbi. אולי נדמו בבלי הדעת להבין ולהבדל בין תדמי לתדמאו, היוצא באלו הדמיון כוזב והטעות מצוי. It's very easy to make a mistake. עוד תולה עצמו באילן גדול, אשר שמו נודה ביהודה, בישראל גדול, אדוננו, מורנו ורבנו, זכר צדיק לברכה. Also, you are hanging yourself on a big tree, namely you're relying on the note of Yehuda. Remember, Mordechai Barnett was also a student in Rabbi Landau's yeshiva. V'chalila sheteitze kazot mefnei hashalit kamohu. It's absolutely impossible that the note of Yehuda could have given such a decision. Uvli safek, no, there's no question, lo hoyu lefanav hadal kanikvashteo lechotik. He never saw a fish, the fish that we know as the sterlet or the tick. Ki ilu kein, because he had actually seen such a fish, hayom otze asher ein kakaskasim niklafin bekli, v'yesh lehem simanei dagin tohori, tmeyim. He certainly would have realized that the scales don't come off with the utensil and they have all the signs of a non-kosher fish. V'ulam, perhaps, al pi tachbulot anshei mirma, perhaps some deceitful individuals, his damein lefanav chaticha midag echad, that someone passed them with some portion of some kind of a fish, v'alpiv harakiv yehemet hadagim ha'elu, v'alpiv harak, and he decided the question on the basis of some small piece of a fish, but he never saw the big fish. Kiv yehemet hadagim ha'ela, these fish, kol v'yehem yakirum ki tmeyim hem. All people who see these fish will recognize them to be non-kosher fish. V'ochlon over v'lotaseh, that anyone who eats them violates a lotaseh, u'bitel mitzvataseh, v'chol kezayit in kezayit. Every mouthful that someone would eat of this fish, he's committing a sin. V'ne'eman olai harav ha'muflag merav Yitzvak avbezdin v'kol akid afax. I certainly believe the chief rabbi Grisaber from Krax, אשר הוא שאל מעט נורנו ועורנו הגאון נורא ביהודה זל על הדוקים האלו, that he says, I believe the claim of a rabbi of Fox who says that he personally asked the rabbi Landau, the nora ביהודה, והורא לו לאיסור, and he told him that these fishes are prohibited, ועוד סיבה עליו להכריז ולפרסם כי יסורם בקרב ישראל, ולזה שונים שאמר כהלכה. Okay. So, Rabbi Landau. No, to the contrary, he did push everything.
So then, how can this person?
We're in the situation where the chief rabbi is dead, and people are now. There's no doubt in my mind that the rabbi Fox simply is lying through his teeth on this matter. But we've seen that with our own eyes. We saw, for example, that immediately after Rabbi Soloveitchik died, at the very funeral, his brother gave the most brilliant hesped I've ever heard and claimed that Rabbi Soloveitchik never had any interest in secular education, had no use for modern knowledge, and all of that was a bluff in order to entice people into the study of Torah. And the only thing that was of any value was the study of Torah. So we were all present.
I heard that.
You were there, and that's exactly.
I remember the young one jumped off the burning temple.
Threw
the keys away, rather.
Well, you missed the main part. You weren't paying attention. This was.
You only had two, three people sitting in
right. Right. At any event, we all know that even as far as Rabbi Soloveitchik was concerned, many things which have been instituted in his name, even in his own shul, as being part of his custom, are simply some things that never had occurred there. You right?
I don't think so.
Such as
the epithems in the Olena poll that suddenly emerged.
He said it privately. He never had it sung out loud.
We always
had a mishaberach for six people, not people standing up and saying. In any event, here is a situation in which the chief rabbi of Moravia is attesting that I believe the rabbi of Fox when he told me that the Note of Yehuda changed his mind and gave him a personal authorization to tell everybody that the fish is no longer kosher. Okay?
that?
Oh, privately.
Right.
But not anybody else.
Right. Okay. Right. So now let's look at what the son of the notary Yehuda has to say about this matter, which is the next tshuva in the handout that I gave last time, which is notary Yehuda Simon Kofet. Okay? So this is the handout from last time. You don't have a copy. The second... do you have it there? Is it right there, the next page after this? Is there one in that page? Is the following page? Let me see if I have some from upstairs. Just a second. I could always print some more out. Right. All right. So now, Shuvami ben Hamachaber, this is printed in the usual note of Yehuda text. This is the Shuva from the son, Rosh Hashem Prag. I'm now going to read a letter from the son of the note of Yehuda, who is a member of the success, the person who is the chief rabbi of Prague after the Notary Yehuda was Rabbi Fleckelis, who was the, but part of the Besdin was the son of the Notary Yehuda Shmuel. L'chvod ha-rav ha-mufla morena rav Yitzchak ha-Besdin v'kerki l'pah. That's again, the rav ha-mufla is again, dear sir. Nechtavo ha-na'im higiyan. Your pleasant letter reached me. That's again, dear sir. You'll get to the hard parts in a minute. V'hinei hikshar l'sh'ol mimenu davar l'achnis atzmi b'davar asher v'machloket shluya. You made it difficult to you because you're asking me to get into a matter which is a matter of dispute. V'ani boreach min ha'machloket l'achnis atzmi b'davar asher k'yatsu l'riv. I certainly want to avoid getting involved in something which is now a public fight. V'choshesh'ani, and I suspect sh'kvar bo'a l'midat ha'nitzuach, that you have now come to the stage in which what matters more is not the truth here, but whether who's going to win this particular dispute. Ah, ho'il v'hadavar nogea v'hora'ah, but since this matter touches upon an issue of actual practice, asher kvar yatsa me'et adoni mori v'rabi ha'gaon zecher tzadik l'bracha, on a matter which my father has decided, lo uchal lehitapek, I cannot refrain from answering you. And you will find attached to this letter, I'm sending you a copy of the letter as you asked, which I have copied from the book Nota Yehuda Mahadura Pnina, from the second edition of Nota Yehuda. Asher heiniach achra bracha kvod adoni avi mori v'rabi ha-gaon, of my father, v'hu machzik kol ha-tshuvot she'ashiv l'sho'olim, this contains all of the response that he answered to questioners, achar ha-tfasat noda b'Yehuda madu ha-kama, after the publication of the first edition of the Noda b'Yehuda. U'mitocho yireh malato, and from this letter, and that's the one that we read last week and briefly summarized tonight, Sha'adoni avi mori v'rabi ha-gaon zal hetir hadag hazeh sha'al alav harav mitu. I don't know what city in Hungary that stands for. He permitted this fish, l'halacha, she'kol dag, any fish, she'kaskasav niklafim in e'or, whose scales can be removed, al yidei shriya b'mei efer she'korim loik, which after being soaked in a lye solution, o ayudei pu'ula acheret, or by any other means, shapir nikra'im kaskasim v'huto'o, that my father explicitly permitted a fish whose scales can be removed by this procedure. V'tama ani, and I am shocked, shekatav ma'alato shadoni avi al-mori v'rabi hazga'on zal hadar me'il me'horazo, that my father changed his mind on this issue. I'm shocked that you can say this. And that he commanded you, that is Rabbi Fox,
to send his retraction letter to the rabbi of, I don't know what Tetvav stands for, some town in Hungary, obviously. Yumchol li ma'alato, forgive me, sir, shadavar zehu sheker muchlat. This is an absolute lie.
Viadua
lechol, everyone knows, Godel Sidkato Shadoni Avimori Rabbi Hagaonzo. Everyone knows how much of my father was a tzaddik. Bahaya Mahir Vizariz Bam Lechet Aktiva, and he was also very efficient at writing. In other words, he had no trouble writing something that he wanted to write. If he really changed his mind, why didn't he himself write to the rabbi who asked him? Because after all, that rabbi knew him well. And he used to be a frequent guest at my father's table. Kama shanim, for many years. If he really had changed his mind, he certainly would have written that to the rabbi who asked him in the first place. V'lo haya someh al ma'alato, and he certainly wouldn't rely on you, liyot shlucho lo'liya hadavah hazeh la'aram abu. He certainly wouldn't rely on you to be his messenger to give this information to that rabbi. V'lo haya nach v'shaket nishlishloch, he gave it al yedei gam l'parcha. He certainly would not have hesitated from sending a letter with a flying camel, that is express mail, l'farseim hadavah li'isu, to let people know that he had changed his mind and now this thing is...